This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. Jason Bivens is a religion professor at NC State who's interested in how faith influences politics. He teaches classes, writes books, and does all those normal things that people in academia do. But he didn't always live in the ivory tower. In his chest beats the heart of a punk rocker. He got into the punk movement in the 1980s in Washington, D.C., where he found not only a shared love of music, but a shared rejection of the mainstream, which at that time included the rise of Ronald Reagan Republicanism and Jerry Falwell Christianity. Jason initially thought his path in life would be a musical one. He and a group of like-minded musicians took off for London to try to make it big, but it wasn't meant to be, and Jason returned to America and academia. He still plays music on the side. He's currently working on a book about jazz and religion. But it's religion and politics that have been the focus of his published work. His most recent book is 2008's Religion of Fear, The Politics of Horror in Conservative Evangelicalism. Jason Bivens, associate professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at NC State, joins us now in the studio. Jason, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks, Isaac. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here, and especially now that we've been in the midst of this most recent religious political intersection battle over the Obama administration and the Catholic bishops and birth control. I'm really excited to talk to you about that, and we will get to that. But I first want to talk to you about how you arrived at this field. So you grew up in Washington, D.C., and your parents worked for the government. What did they do?
Well, my father worked for the vast majority of his career for NASA. He actually started out with that administration, I think, at its inception. But certainly, during my entire lifetime, he worked for NASA. And my mom worked for a time for the Library of Congress. After my parents split, she got out of that and began working in library informatics, search technology, and this kind of thing. But yeah, we were very much government kids.
So, and with a dad in NASA, did you have dreams of going to the moon yourself one day or being an astronaut?
Of a sort, I certainly had dreams of an interstellar variety, but I think I was filtering them largely through the experience of being a comic book fan. So, maybe not the moon, but some distant planet.
And I know that your father was there at NASA during the Challenger disaster, which would have been when you were a teenager, I suppose.
Yeah, high school.
What do you remember about that? I mean, that must have been a real formative experience for you and a major experience for your father, of course.
Yeah, it absolutely was formative. I remember hearing the announcement while I was eating lunch in the school cafeteria, and coming home that day was very, very jarring. And my father, who actually, he had a job, loosely speaking, kind of trying to recycle materials from previous space missions. He was sort of furious at the budget cuts that had been laid upon the agency by the Reagan administration, and was sort of incensed to think that an unnecessary cutting of corners might have actually eventuated in the crash, at least on some level. So it was part of a kind of broader animus in our household against the changes taking place during the 1980s, changes of priorities, national priorities.
So it sounds sort of the beginning of some political awareness, some political awakening on your part.
Yeah, it was. It might have been more of a kind of cementing experience. The awakening had sort of begun a few years earlier, but yeah, I remember the 1980s as being, aside from the fact that I was lucky to have a great family and great friends, I remember it as being a very alienating time as somebody sort of coming into an awareness about politics and a larger world of culture and values and justice and things like that.
Well, since you are in the field of religion and politics, what was the religious tenor of your household as a kid? What was that like? How did the religious landscape look to you looking out from that household?
Yeah, it was a very interesting one. My father was a very religious person. My mother remains not a very religious person. She was raised Catholic and left Catholicism more or less as quickly as she could. But my father was an Episcopalian, and so when we would stay on weekends with our dad, we would go to church, and it was a very, I guess people would now call it a progressive Episcopalian church. I would not have recognized that language at the time, nor did anything seem particularly abnormal at the time. But it was the kind of church where, for example, if there was an episode of police brutality in our neighborhood, and this was Capitol Hill, it would be not uncommon to see police tape around the pulpits. I also thought it was very normal for women to preach. There were all kinds of things that I later learned were not necessarily customary. And I myself was not a religious person, nor was any pressure put on me to be one by my family. But it was a period of continual exposure. And so coming out of that exposure, even though the metaphysics of religion kind of challenged me intellectually, I thought of Christianity and my upbringing as a very sort of positive, warming, community-oriented thing. And it was really when I discovered alternate expressions of Christianity that I became curious about the gap between them.
What do you mean by that? I mean, what gap were you seeing? I mean, I suppose that time was when somebody like Jerry Falwell was first getting exposed to a wider American audience.
Yeah. And that's really right when it happened, sort of. You know, Falwell clearly came on the national scene beginning in 79, but he sort of crossed my radar in the early to mid-1980s. And I think it's very easy for people who grow up in big cities to be relatively sheltered. But nonetheless, when I first saw Falwell on TV and then read about him in the newspapers, in the Washington Post, I was curious at how different his expression of Christianity was from that I had grown up exposed to, both my father's and my grandmother's and my uncle's and so on and so forth. And within our family and really for everybody we knew, Christianity was inseparable from a kind of concern for poverty, discrimination, and these kinds of things. And when I heard Jerry Falwell, it seemed to be a much more kind of apocalyptic, judgmental, strident version of interpretation of the gospel, I should say, not version interpretation, which really didn't register to me, and this, I suppose, gets back to my limits of seeing at the time, didn't register to me as Christian.
Hmm. So you, at this time, became interested in the punk movement in D.C. Describe what that movement was like at that time in D.C.
Well, it was weird. I sort of learned about it on the fly, you know. My story is a very typical one. I was a sort of marginalized nerdy kid, and I was friends with all the other marginalized nerdy kids. And I think when you have that experience, and it usually doesn't exist before junior high, which is the great sort of Lord of the Flies experience we all go through, right? You sort of learn that you're a weirdo or something like that. And so my friends and I bonded together, and I think we were initially attracted by the visual otherness of punk culture. You know, we were way too young to be into it ourselves, but at the age of sort of 11, 12, we were sort of compelled by photographs, by hairstyles, by clothing, you know, all the iconography of punk. And we said, you know, okay, those people also seem to be outsiders, but they also seem to be kind of literary, interested in kind of artistic expression. They were doing something with their experience of marginality. And so initially that visual experience was very compelling to us. We also went looking for different sounds. And so, you know, this was really the point in my life where, always a music fan, sound became a way of pursuing my oblique angle to my culture. Hmm. And the same for all my friends. So, you know, we sort of dove into punk and post-punk and goth and a whole stew of things as a way of expressing this alterity, and really just went from there.
What was that? So what were you doing, and what were the experiences like of going to shows? And I guess, I mean, what's the experience like that is providing this sort of catharsis for you, I suppose?
Yeah, the first experience, and I remember it very, very vividly, the first show I saw that was not kind of a mainstream show was actually The Cure in 1982 or 1983. I was very young. But lining up outside of the Ontario Theatre, so this is not technically speaking a punk show, but lining up outside the Ontario Theatre, I saw all kinds of people with funny hair and clothes. And my first thought, as was the case with my buddy who was with me, was, oh, look, there's other people like us. This is great. You know, so it was almost like a gathering of a tribe that was separate during, you know, the average weekday. And it was a really, really uplifting sort of feeling. You know, it allowed us for a kind of emotional expression that was unavailable to us regularly.
And you, tell me about the first time you were in a mosh pit. I understand that you may have been hurt in your first mosh experience.
Yeah, so this is very, very, so my first actual punk rock show was in the spring of 1985 at the Bethesda, Maryland Community Center. And I was going to see a band I really liked called Dag Nasty. And a couple of these guys, well, one guy, Brian Baker, had been in Minor Threat, which was kind of the iconic DC punk band, who I was sort of too young to see in their heyday. Broke up in 83. So my friends and I piled in the car. We were just learning to drive, and we went over to the community center. And there was a big crowd, and the band was getting ready to go on. And what one does when one goes to a show is you approach the stage, you get as close as possible, because you want to be connected to the band's energy. when the music started up, I felt all these bodies kind of slamming into me, and I had no idea that I suppose I had seen films of sort of 1977 stuff in England, but they were just pogoing, jumping up and down. And it was really the lateral space that was being kind of jeopardized in my experience. And so I ended up on the ground because I didn't know, and I got stepped on. I wasn't aware that this was going to happen, and I wasn't prepared to deal with it. But immediately I was helped up, and that was that.
Did that make you think... Did you have moments of doubt about your engagement with the punk scene at that moment, or did it have the opposite effect?
I had a moment of doubt. You know, I mean, my engagement with the punk scene was not. You know, I didn't necessarily want any kind of physical violence. And the interesting thing about the DC scene was that, you know, a mosh pit was actually relatively rare. I think you would almost call it a hippie punk scene at that time, because, you know, so a lot of the bands really didn't want a pit. They really didn't want violence. They wanted a kind of attentiveness, studiousness, almost like a communion of sorts. It was the beginning of the rise of bands like Rites of Spring and so forth, who were much more into kind of emotional catharsis than physical catharsis. And it was that really appealed to me more than the physical.
This is The State of Things. We're talking today with Jason Bivens, Associate Professor of Religion at NC State University. Just ahead, we'll talk with Jason about a trip to London and an attempt to make a music career, and then coming back and getting into academia and how religion shapes political discourse and vice versa. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. Today we're talking with Jason Bivens. He's an associate professor of religion at NC State University. And we were talking about your engagement with the punk movement in D.C. As a teenager. Of course, then you went off to college. How did your musical interest change in college?
You know, they had begun to change at the tail end of high school. I happened into a huge trough of vinyl jazz records, and I'd never really been that engaged with jazz previously. But somewhere between the end of my junior year and senior year in high school, I became really interested in jazz, not to the detriment of other stuff. But when I got to Oberlin College in Ohio, with its incredibly rich music education and multiple scenes, I really, I maintained my interest in punk and various kinds of heavy music, but I was exposed to a lot of classical music, but particularly I got really, really into jazz and avant-garde music. And the bands I was in college, particularly one band, Sweatbox, what we were trying to do was take the basic heavy urgency of punk and combine that with a kind of improvisational sensibility and with a technicality that some people associate now with kind of prog rock or math rock, you know. So basically we were listening to a lot of King Crimson and Miles Davis records and wanted to shoehorn that into punk somehow.
And after college, you went to London with Sweatbox, yes?
Yeah.
To try to make a career out of it. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, it was really, really interesting. My mother and stepfather lived in London for a very long time, and through a great deal of assistance on their part, the band had an opportunity to spend some time in London. So we all shacked up together in a tiny house in Finsbury Park, about two blocks from the Arsenal football stadium, which itself was an adventure. And we hit town. We sent out a demo tape that we'd recorded in our senior year. And right off the bat, we got a ton of club dates. And in a town that size, it was really, really difficult to build a following. And we were very committed to the music, and we actually had a good deal of label interest from the start. But shows were a little difficult. But after about a year and a half, we ended up coming back to Washington, D.C. and splitting up pretty quickly. And it was at that time that I decided, okay, maybe the academic life, which I'd always been very enthusiastic about as well while at college, I thought, okay, maybe as a day job, music is not going to happen for me.
Well, how did your interest in music and your experience of the punk movement and then those changes in your musical taste, how did all of that influence your academic interests?
I mean, that's a question I think about a lot. And I'm always sort of pleased to see the way that things hang together. One of the earliest experiences or lessons learned about punk rock and kind of quote-unquote alternative music in the 1980s was that it promoted a kind of curiosity, a questioning of values that were taken for granted, a questioning of conventional wisdom, and really sort of developing one's own individuality and sense of community outside of expectations. And that way of thinking about things and thinking about myself lent itself very naturally, I think, to a kind of academic passion. And with regard to the study of religion, which I had gravitated to in college, that initial line of questioning opened up when I tried to assess the distance between Falwell and my family, quite honestly. I became ever more curious about that because those forces didn't seem to be going anywhere. And so the questioning of the taken for granted is really the glue that knits the things together.
It would seem that in recent decades, and I wonder what you think about this, that maybe the great success of the conservative evangelical movement, Falwell et al., has been not to convince other religious people that they're the only face of Christianity, but to convince non-religious people that they're face of that, and that you can't be religious without being conservative. And therefore, it's really kind of sundered alliances between progressive religious and secular groups.
Yeah, I would agree entirely with that formulation. And in fact, that's one of the things that interested me the most when I began to study this series of problems in particular at graduate school. In a way, when I first became familiar with the groups you just mentioned, Isaac, you know, sort of earlier progressive, radical Christians and so forth, stretching from sort of the latter half of even the early 19th century into the 1960s, really, I became fascinated with them, first in a kind of vain way. I thought of them as kind of early expressions of a sort of punk rock DIY Christianity. But then, you know, I realized the limits of those categories. But I was fascinated as to why these traditions, which seemed more familiar to me given the family I grew up in, I was really curious and more than a little vexed about the disappearance of these traditions. And so with my dissertation, which became my first book, The Fracture of Good Order, I really wanted to sort of pursue a couple of different ideas. One was to explore the vitality of these earlier modes of religious activism, if you will, but also suggest that they shared with the right some grievances about mainstream political organization. So it was a way of sort of decentering the ubiquity of conservative religiosity.
I'm really interested by what you said in the midst of that as about looking back on some of these traditions and seeing in them this punk rock almost feeling of DIY. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I think the best way to do that is by example. One of the groups in particular that I became fascinated with was the Berrigan brothers, Daniel and Philip Berrigan, and their circle of like-minded Catholic, although not always Catholic, activists beginning in the 1960s. And these guys, through a number of kind of engagements in the 1950s and 60s with Catholic social teaching, with political radicalism, you know, the 60s counterculture, various kinds of arts movements and so forth, they came to believe that the only way to be a Christian was to separate oneself radically from Babylon, essentially, that there was something inherently wicked about the political culture that has developed in the United States, and that once one has separated oneself completely, which is, you know, I saw it as kind of analogous to living in a squat or something like that. Once one has separated, one has to engage in kind of acts of protest that alert observers like us to the critical principles that they believe are really integral to Christianity. So, for example, one of the things that they got up to was they would, in the fall of 1967, they raided a draft board in Baltimore, Maryland, and they had gone to a butcher shop and purchased a bunch of pig's blood at the end of the day, and they spilled pig's blood all over draft files, you know, but they had to do what they could. It wasn't technically the blood of the lamb, but it was the blood of the pig, you know. So they would engage in these very flamboyant theatrical protests as a way of kind of jarring people into a new way of thinking. And I saw that as sort of similar to things that I had been exposed to in musical cultures growing up.
And that idea of is keeping oneself separate from Babylon, as you put it, or separate from worldly things, and especially politics, is something that it would seem existed largely in conservative religious circles as well until maybe about mid-century. And I know that you write about this, and that the what you were seeing, what we were all seeing in the 1980s, with the real rise of the Christian right, was a flowering of something that began earlier with this very conscious decision that we're actually going to engage with politics rather than seeing staying separate from it as the way to stay pure. Can you talk about how that shift happened?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I think that's very well put. I think it's less of a shift than people customarily realize. And here I'm going to rely on the work of the great historian Joel Carpenter. There was this kind of popular sense that after the Scopes monkey trial of the 1920s, right-wing Christians went underground, you know, purportedly retreating from a kind of public humiliation and so on and so forth. What actually happened was, yeah, in a certain sense, conservative evangelicals did go underground, but they didn't retreat into a period of inactivity. What they did was begin to, among other things, they began to develop alternate media by which social formations could occur. And talking particularly about radio, about print culture, and later about television and things like this. So there was a world of, there was almost a conservative paraculture, if you will, that really established a way to articulate conservative religious ideas outside of party politics, outside of social movements and things like that. So by the time you get a kind of shifting of national political orientations, a shifting of the scales in the 1970s, this paraculture was already in place to circulate ideas and so forth. So I think it's the combination of those two developments, one widely known, the other less known, that really changed the game beginning in the 70s and 80s.
Speaking of that paraculture that's less known, in your most recent book, Religion of Fear, The Politics of Horror in Conservative Evangelicalism, you write largely about, you take four examples, essentially, of this paraculture, mm-hmm. And specifically examples that seem to have correlations to kind of horror movies and that kind of culture, which is so fascinating. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about a couple of those, especially Hell Houses, uh-huh. and the Left Behind series, which is the Left Behind series of books has sold millions and millions of copies, and yet it's something that I think many secular people have never heard of.
That's right, or might not know particularly where it comes from. So I had a series of questions after I finished my first book. You know, what I'm up to do in most of my work is mapping the contours of religious discontent, forms of religious social criticism. But after the first book, I grew concerned that I had left a major issue unexplored, which is what we might call the sentimental education of particular political religions. And so as the 2000s opened, I wanted to explore a specific brand of religiosity, conservative evangelical religiosity. And the way I wanted to approach this was to pose the following question. What does it say about the health of American democracy that flamboyant, gore-soaked, apocalyptic ideas, which seemed so outré in the beginning of the 1960s, so clearly marginal, the kind of stuff you would associate with like the John Birch Society or Billy James Hargis, what does it say about our culture that these ideas have moved precisely to the center of American culture, not just through national political figures like George W. Bush, but also, as you suggest, Isaac, through the Left Behind series? And for years, you know, you couldn't throw a dart in an airport lounge without hitting one of these books with their sleek black covers and things like this. So I chose to chronicle these transformations in American public discourse and to show the way in which American citizens broadly, not just conservative evangelicals, and it was not my intent to demonize the right, but to explore transformations in political religions and also in how we think about them. The way I wanted to do this was to isolate four stages of the development of what I call the religion of fear. It goes back to very old traditions, all the way back to the Puritans, you know, and this kind of doomstruck mood has been a regular feature of American life, which is worth thinking about itself, why a country of great privilege in many ways taxed so regularly to the sense of kind of embattlement and persecution and so forth. Mm. But so I started with this series of evangelical cartoon tracks produced by a very, very interesting fringe figure known as Jack Chick, who many people believe, interestingly enough, is a kind of punk rock figure within evangelical circles. I once asked somebody why they made that characterization. They said, because he controls his own distribution, like as if he's an independent record label or something. Huh. Tracing the flowering of these kinds of apocalyptic images, very, very kind of lurid, almost gleeful depictions of damnation and judgment and things like this. Trace this through the 1970s in anti-rock and rap censorship campaigns, which also gets us into the 80s. And then I get to the two examples that you mentioned. Beginning in the 1990s, well, a tradition that actually has its roots in Jerry Falwell's university, Liberty University, going back to the 70s. Falwell sponsored the production of alternative haunted houses. And the term he came up with was scaremare. His sense was that exposing the youth, and this is a recurrent trope, youth at risk, right? Exposing the youth to conventional horror displays, horror representations, vampires, witches, ghouls, and so forth, was undesirably celebrating the occult, or at least not undermining the occult. And that it was incumbent upon him, Falwell believed, to expose evangelical youth to what he considered the real horrors they might face in their lives. Rock records, abortion, premarital sex, drunk driving, this kind of thing. Along the way, in the early 1980s, this tradition gets picked up by two particular pastors. Tom Hudgens of Clearwater, Florida, begins something called Judgment House. But more interestingly and more sensationally, Keenan Roberts of Arvada, Colorado, begins to sponsor what he calls hell houses. And the hell houses, they take the basic Falwell template, which is we're going to present real-life horrors, but they present them in, quite honestly, even if you're a horror fan, they present them in an incredibly shocking manner. They have very, very gruesome abortion scenes that are displayed. And we have to remember, let me describe what is actually happening in terms of space here. You have a church basement that is basically mocked up as a series of scenes, and several times a day during the Halloween season, people line up to be led through what is effectively a haunted house in a church basement. So the first room you go into might be an abortion scene where kids ranging from 10 to 16, 17, but it's actually not uncommon to see kids who are much younger, kids are being shown an abortion, and you see a young woman strapped onto a medical table with a blood-soaked white hospital gown. Mm. And great care is given to the viscera of these scenes. And this is where the shock comes in. So at almost every abortion scene I'm familiar with, you hear and see at one point a bunch of meat plopping into a plastic bucket, which is meant to represent the fetus and the brutality of the procedure.
This absolutely sounds like the worst and scariest haunted house that could
absolutely
that I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
And what's interesting too, and you draw this parallel, this is the same time, of course, that slasher flicks in secular culture are becoming so popular, which I suppose is part of what spurred Jerry Falwell and his allies on to do this. But you seem to suggest too that that more broadly, our reactions to and our enjoyment of slasher flicks, for instance, and horror films, is the same thing that's happening in a lot of ways for people who are experiencing these hell houses, or who are experiencing something in, say, the Left Behind series, where it's Armageddon and everyone's been raptured and everyone's being killed.
Yeah. And I really think, you know, there's something powerful happening between the 60s and the 2000s, and it's happening most visibly in conservative religious cultures, although the engine might not be in conventional party formations and things like that. I tend to think of politics as something much broader than the electoral, for example. But the cultural pools on which the conservative religious activists are drawing are shared ones, I think. You know, there's something deep in American culture, as you're suggesting. There's some degree to which we establish American identities through the tropes of horror, through the tropes of the apocalyptic. And I think that is, you know, on the one hand, I've just said that it's very normal, but the deepening of that discourse during a time of political discontent, political apathy, and a radical legitimation crisis for American democracy, quite frankly, I think they stoke each other's fires in some ways that are of great concern. And so I wanted to document that on some level.
And do you think that we're seeing that in current day politics, even the current a presidential campaign, not specifically the horror slasher element necessarily, but certainly there does seem to be a lot of apocalyptic language.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere, you know. And I think a lot of people thought that after the Bush presidency and with the arrival of the Obama presidency, that something in the discourse would change. And clearly that's not been the case. The way I'm putting it these days is that the discourse has actually been put on spin cycle. You know, everything's gotten louder and faster and weirder. And in the space of a very few years, one of the things that we share as citizens is our co-residence in a kind of atmosphere of absurd, fantastical allegations about each other. And our shared politics now consists in these allegations and truth, factuality, reasonability, authenticity. You know, these things are secondary at best. So in a certain sense, the mood of the apocalyptic abides, but the imagery has shifted to one of kind of embattlement and persecution. Everybody is under the gun. Everybody's being oppressed. That's what it means to be an American these days.
We'll talk more about that and also bring the conversation back to music when our conversation continues. My guest this hour is Jason Bivens, Associate Professor of Religion at NC State University. And you're listening to The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Isaac Davy Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour with Jason Bivens. He's an Associate Professor of Religion at NC State University. And before the break, Jason, you were saying that what you think characterizes a lot of political culture now, perhaps even historically, is everyone's a victim, mm-hmm. everyone's persecuted. And I know that when you first got into your study of religion and politics, you were approaching this as largely a conservative evangelical culture of, of victimhood, and you've come to think that it's much broader than that. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, and this is a research project that's still in its opening phases. But one of the things that I was always fascinated by the rhetoric of embattlement and persecution as I encountered it in conservative culture. But as I began to think more about the shapes that actually takes in public discourse, I started to notice that progressive denunciations of conservatism looked an awful lot like conservative claims to embattlement and persecution. So I actually started to study the comparative discourses, the twinned discourses. And I'm looking at, so to the extent that my first two studies of religion and politics look at subcultural formations, I'm now actually very interested in overdetermined politics, that is, political formations which get an awful lot of mainstream attention, because it's in these spaces that I think we see the shared discourse between what we might clumsily call the left and the right. So as we look at, for example, Sarah Palin's candidacy for the vice presidency, Michelle Bachmann's and Rick Perry's candidacies for the presidency this year, the Tea Party, the scandals surrounding the proposed ban on Sharia law in Tennessee, David Barton's pseudo-history. These, Glenn Beck is another example. As we look at these very, very prominent examples from our political culture over the last couple of years, I think we see that not only are the conservatives who are being addressed in these examples articulating this discourse of embattlement, those who denounce Glenn Beck, denounce the Tea Party and so forth, denounce Sarah Palin, are often resorting to the same kinds of claims, the same kinds of arguments, suggesting that, no, we, the secularists, for example, are the true Americans. We understand the meanings of the founders and the Constitution. We have a clear and concise sense of our national history and our national priorities. Very, very similar to the structure we encounter in Beck, Palin, Barton et al.
Well, let's talk about one particular example that's still playing out right now, and that is, of course, this battle between the Obama White House and the Catholic bishops and their allies over a mandate that employers cover birth control in their health insurance. What does this battle tell us about what you're describing and even more broadly about the intersection of religion and politics these days?
Yeah, it's a fascinating example. Couldn't have popped up at a more convenient time in terms of this conversation, you know. But the fact of the matter is things like this are continually popping up. And before I address the specific issue, I think it's worth thinking about the very regularity of these kinds of grievance claims and so forth. But what I found significant about this past week's episode was not necessarily that it represented another squabble regarding the Catholic Church and sexual politics, right? These kinds of things are very regular themselves post-Vatican II, Post Humanae Vitae, right, referring to a specific papal encyclical from the Second Vatican Council. What I found,
which explicitly banned birth control for Catholics, right?
Yes. So what I found interesting was that the issue was almost immediately defined as one about religious liberty. Mm-hmm. You know, and so this is the kind of shared sense of embattlement that really fascinates me, and a perfect illustration of how central these tropes are to our discourse now. I can certainly see the reasoning of the Catholic bishops if there's thought to be a compulsion, a coercion, and so forth. It's not that this is completely irrelevant to what we might consider to be religious liberty, but all other claims were tabled, and it immediately became a sense of the Obama administration constraining religious liberty, which is a claim that has gone kind of viral in conservative cultures more broadly over the last couple years.
I wonder if you think, too, that whatever the merits of the argument on both sides— that the bishops and their allies also want the fight. I mean, you write in your book that the moral order that conservative religious leaders want to defend needs demons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we need fights more, you know, and again, this is sort of what I'm coming to in terms of broader realizations about American politics. We all define ourselves, whether through our demons or our opponents, through the fight. And it's the fight that actually creates something. The fight creates a self, the fight creates a community, and the fight also creates religion in the sense that it defines an identifiable public category around which we can continue our struggle. So religion becomes the subject of our struggle, but also the vehicle, the idiom by which the struggle is articulated. And that's a fascinating conjunction.
You've written that religion has been having a degrading effect on politics. Describe what you mean by that, and if you see a more positive route for that.
I think it's more accurate to say that the degradation of politics in general has been accompanied by an intense religious investment. You know, I wouldn't want to, and this gets back to my early fascination with kind of alternate sources of religious activism and interpretation and things like that. I wouldn't want to say that religion as such is a degrading force, because all of a sudden I would be, you know, Sam Harris and Chris Hitchens and these kinds of folks who I think are really not very nuanced thinkers about what religion is and the way it circulates in much more subtle ways. However, I think the degradation of public discourse over the last 30, 40, 50 years is of tremendous concern, and greater clarity about what religions are actually up to might shake us out of conventional ways of thinking in ways that could facilitate reimagining the possibilities of politics. And it might be the case that certain religious traditions can and will participate in that, but I am interested in the ways in which religions serve as a lens through which to view these larger processes of political decline.
And certainly our discourse, and I mean particularly, say, our cable news discourse, but even perhaps our public radio discourse is not terribly nuanced about all of the multitudes that make up various religions, and how even this fight we were just talking about over birth control is an intra-religious fight as much as it's a fight between religious people and secular people.
Yeah, that's right. And what I find so fascinating is that given the availability of all kinds of information, the rapid access we can have to almost all of it, I find it fascinating that this feel for nuance you just described still doesn't exist. You know, the more people are exposed to ambiguity, multiplicity, and so on and so forth, the more we all seem to resist it, comfortable within our, you know, I call it the epistemology of favorites, right? We approach our lives, we approach our political thinking the way we construct a favorites list for internet browsing, you know? So I think we're all far more comfortable within the boundaries that we establish individually and collectively, and that bodes ill as well.
Well, we've been talking about religion and politics, and I want to end our conversation by talking about the intersection of religion and music, which is your other great passion. As we mentioned, you left music for a career in academia, but you've never really stopped playing.
That's right.
You're still a musician. You've played in a number of bands. You've put out some albums. How did your music experience change after you went back into academia?
I basically, the experience of being in these rock bands and trying to quote unquote make it didn't leave me with a distaste for rock, but I wanted to, on the one hand, explore my nascent familiarity with jazz and avant-garde music a little bit more, but also take a break from rock music, which I'd grown to feel was excessively formulaic, excessively for me, that is, and kind of hidebound as a genre. So when I got to graduate school, I was already in the process of basically swapping out my rock record collection for a good jazz record collection, and it was my good fortune within the first month in Bloomington, Indiana, to meet a committed series of free improvisers who were basically taking off from post-John Coltrane traditions of jazz improvisation and trying to take music into a non-idiomatic territory. And that kind of scratchy, proto-industrial, almost non-instrumental kind of sound making had a deep connection with 20th century classical music in a certain sense, but also with the kind of skronky industrial stuff that I had listened to, at least to some extent, growing up as a punk kid. So I was fascinated by this music, by the possibility of, on the one hand, trying to learn how to play my guitar better and better and better, which jazz requires, but also trying to learn how to make my guitar sound like something other than a guitar. So I basically fell in love with jazz music in all of its varieties, and because of the intense music scene in Bloomington, Indiana, I was fortunate enough to make a lot of friendships that were musical primarily and played in a ton of bands. And by the end of graduate school, I had begun my recording records and so forth. So it was really, really great. It was a process of seduction and another means by which, and this is a sort of continuity, I could explore sound as a register of my distance from quote-unquote normal culture.
Well, let's hear an example of what we're talking about. This is you and your band. Is this the Unstable Ensemble?
This is actually a duet with Ian Davis, a longtime friend and musical collaborator. Ian is a brilliant percussionist who, for a long time, was spearheading a large ensemble called the Micro East Collective, which basically gathered together all the Triangle folks, including WUNC's own Patty Painter Wakefield, I should say, in a large ensemble devoted to exploring these kinds of music making. But this is a duet that Ian and I did, an album of duets.
And this is called Idiot Fish from the album Benthic. Jason Bivens with Idiot Fish off the album Benthic. And here's what I want to ask you about that. That's difficult for the untrained ear to hear. Can you tell me how to hear that in a way?
Yeah, well, first of all, listen to Ian. Ian is rocking. You know, there's a kind of pulse underneath it all, but it's a loose pulse. It's not a constrictive four-on-the-floor kind of rock or funk pulse, I say with great love and affection for those kinds of rhythmic basses. But the first thing to know about this music is that it's free from conventional rhythm and harmony, free from the restrictions one encounters in particularly scripted forms of even jazz music making. And jazz is thought to be a kind of freedom music across the board, and it is. But non-idiomatic improvisation seeks to dive really all the way into the abyss. No template whatsoever. Boom, start playing. The question is, if you're not playing, is it interesting to listen to? Well, at least a few people seem to think so. But what Ian and I wanted to do on this record was to strip the context down to the unvarnished duo and see if we could come up with something that was freely improvised but had a kind of compositional sense. So this particular piece was built on the kind of ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And I established an electronic loop using a delay pedal, and the melodic lines, although they're kind of craggy and non-conventional melodic lines, the melodic lines are meant to sort of dip in and out of the pulse. But of course, we never talked about any of this beforehand. Mm-hmm. It just kind of emerged in real time.
Well, and you're working on a book about the relationship between jazz and religion. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship?
Well, it it's something that became apparent to me in my college days when I first got kind of seduced by the music of John Coltrane, Wadada Leo Smith, Anthony Braxton, Sun Ra, and a bunch of travelers, Coltrane being the exception here, travelers in the American underground. When I would sort of read jazz journalism and jazz reviews, it was very, very regular for musicians to talk about the spirituality of the music. There's something about improvisation that served as a kind of ritual, a catharsis, a form of communing with or connecting to higher things. But most of the reviews would actually kind of poo-poo these sentiments among the musicians, which I thought was deeply unfair, and actually missed something that was vital to the music. So I was studying religion and politics the whole time, but I began in 1997 to write music reviews of my own. So I've been kind of active. That's a kind of moonlighting thing I've been doing for quite a long time. And as I've gathered bits of information here and there, this sense that religiosity and music making are intimately linked for jazzers, this sense has only deepened. And I've gathered tons and tons of examples from early jazz, contemporary jazz, examples of ritual, of metaphysical system building, of community building, religion in a whole host of different modes of expression. And I noticed after several years and after having given snuck out a couple of talks on this topic, I noticed that I had about 500 or 600 pages in a Word document. So I thought, man, I might as well turn this into something. And this is my way of writing a happy story about American culture.
Well, and I've certainly heard some practitioners of jazz call it the most American music, not just because of its evolution and its history, but also because it's ensemble but with solo riffing.
Right.
And I wonder if you buy that as well.
You know, I think there's a kind of hokiness to that discourse on some level. But I also know that it has meant a great deal to a much broader swath of musicians than one might think ordinarily. I think at first blush, one would associate that discourse with, say, Dr. Billy Taylor or somebody like that, possibly Wynton Marsalis, you know, Stanley Crouch, Wynton Marsalis, the world of the Ken Burns documentary, you know. And I do think there's something to it. That's a powerful animating principle in jazz history. But not everybody has shared that principle. And some have taken that principle in very, very different directions. In terms of not sharing it, think only of the close relationship between a certain kind of nascent avant-garde jazz in the mid-50s to mid-60s and, if not rejections of democracy, at least profound criticisms of democracy. So think about Charles Mingus's Fables of Phoebus, Max Roach and Abby Lincoln's We Insist, Freedom Now, Sweet, which were these excoriations of American democracy as something that wasn't working for black people. So the discourse has limits. But I'm interested in those limits, and I'm interested in the ways in which, for a lot of musicians, either jazz, religion, and democracy work together, or jazz and religion take you perhaps out of democracy into alternate modes of organizing.
Well, Jason Bivens, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Really happy to have you.
My pleasure.
Jason Bivens is an associate professor of religion at NC State University. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show or want to hear archived editions of past programs, go to our website at stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Alex Granados. Robin Copley is the technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is the senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio.